loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Special Counsel Robert Mueller issued indictments today against 13 Russian citizens and three Russian entities, and he announced one charge against an American as part of the Russia probe. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said there is no evidence of Russia influencing the outcome of the 2016 election, and no American citizen was involved wittingly. Next, the bipartisan immigration bill failed in the Senate yesterday, as did President Trump's unpopular immigration bill, dooming prospects for reform and casting doubt on the future of dreamers in this country. Then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson arrived in Turkey today in an attempt to repair relations between the two NATO allies. Those relations have frayed over allegations that the U.S. supported a coup against Turkish President Erdogan last year, as well as Turkish demands that the U.S. end support of Kurds in Syria. And then Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai is being investigated by the FCC Inspector General over allegations that he improperly scrapped regulations to benefit conservative Sinclair Broadcasting in its purchase of rival Tribune Media. And finally, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to that Russia probe. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we're joined from Washington by Jim Jatras. He's a political analyst and former U.S. diplomat. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here.
Glad you're here. Thank you. So this is big news today. These indictments came down. 13 Russian citizens, apparently, three Russian entities, and an American in Los Angeles, California. We were looking at the indictment itself, and I want to ask both of you, what do you make of the charges? Let's start with Jim Cavanaugh. Go right ahead.
Well, again, first of all, nothing to do with the Trump or the Trump campaign, did not affect the election. We have a private Russian company that tried to do something, and some of it was nasty. Obviously, the identity theft, setting up fake accounts. I will call your attention to the very end, paragraph 95. It turns out that they were using these accounts to receive money in exchange for posting promotions and advertisements. Defendants and their co-conspirators typically charge certain U.S. merchants and social media between $25 and $50 per post for promotional content on their false accounts. So maybe this was just a scam, you know, that people use to create, like journalists who bought Twitter followers to create false accounts in order to make money. Could be that.
Well, when you say scam, it could be, in other words, a commercial enterprise.
Right.
That's what you mean. In other words, an organization like this Internet Research Agency, like many, many other organizations in social media, mass media, who see the American election campaign as just a cash cow because so much money is spent on promotion. I mean, this indictment, Jim Jatras, does not mention the Russian government at all. I mean, I think it's kind of important because when we talk about the Russians, it's now a generic label meaning all things. It means the Russian intelligence, Vladimir Putin, the Kremlin, the Russian commercial entities, all Russian people. I mean, that's where we are right now. Go ahead.
That's absolutely right. I mean, any random con man who may be have any connection to Russia at all is now a beeline straight to the Kremlin and to Vladimir Putin personally. I mean, this is ridiculous. Even if you look at this indictment on its face and take all the facts alleged in it as true, which I certainly don't, but for the sake of argument, what you've got here is, at worst, the kind of garden variety kicking each other under the table that a lot of countries do to each other routinely, electronically, for various reasons, as well as private entities. And frankly, this stuff doesn't even compare to the kind of stuff we do to queer other people's elections in the way that we would want to twist them. So I don't really think there's that much here. I think the real purpose of this is the Empire Strikes Back. Over the past few weeks, we've seen so much about how this cabal within the government, the Justice Department, the FBI, the State Department, the CIA have been mixed up. And by the way, I would also include MI6 and GCHQ as being involved in this, had been trying to subvert the rule of law, the constitutional system. That is a story that is, as I think, a blockbuster in American history. And this is a diversion. This is an attempt to come back and say, never mind all this. Look at that. Russia, Russia, Russia.
Jim Jatras, it looks like, according to the indictment, the IRA, this agency from St. Petersburg, was trying to get clickbait on all kinds of issues. Some of them are left. Some of them are anti-Trump. Some of them are pro-Trump. Some of them are pro-Bernie Sanders. Many of them, or maybe all of them, are against Hillary Clinton. This campaign began in 2014. The indictment says the only people it says are decidedly in the favor of this promotional enterprise is Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. In other words, the right and the left. But then again, this is like you put a drop of water into an ocean and say the ocean has been polluted by this drop of water, given the amount of money and intervention by different commercial and non-commercial entities, including 501c3s, and creating all kinds of accounts. I mean, when you get back down to the indictment, in spite of the breathless headlines, it doesn't seem like there's not much there.
No, there isn't. And as you say, it's just a drop of water here. The amount of money we're talking about being spent here, the lack of coordination of the message is it makes no sense, except if you buy the nonsense that this was somehow meant to set Americans against each other and to undermine confidence in our democracy, as though we need any foreigners to do that. I mean, as though we're not at each other's throats for lots of other reasons anyway. But there is a poison pill in there where they do say that it is designed to give a positive view of Donald Trump and a negative view of Hillary Clinton. So I think they're still trying to tag the Trump people with the fruits of collusion, even if they can't show any collusion.
This campaign, though, began according to the indictment, in April 2014.
Right.
The organization formed a department that went by various names, but was at times referred to as the Translator Project. This project focused on the U.S. population and conducted operations on social media platforms such as YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Again, though, when I think of it as a social justice activist, what the indictment is basically saying is if you are out in the streets for Black Lives Matter,
yeah,
if you are out in the streets for gun control or in defense of the Second Amendment and against gun control, if you are for Bernie Sanders or you are for Donald Trump, if you are for anything, if you had an opinion, if you were an activist, you were either wittingly or unwittingly a stooge of this
yes.
omnipresent IRA force from St. Petersburg.
You were duped.
In a way, I think maybe the big picture here will be that this is another part of the war against dissent in America. Like, if you're in the streets, if you're protesting, if you're advocates, you're really just a tool of some foreign government. I mean, in my opinion, that might be one of the biggest problems here.
Yeah, it's forcing people to apologize for dissent and to preface everything, well, I'm not a Russian, but I happen to be outside the window that's defined by Ted Cruz on the right and Hillary Clinton on the left, or whatever you call it, right and left. And anything outside of that margins is something that's, as you say, been ginned up by the Russians, that they invented the discord and the dissent that's outside those margins. It's kind of crazy. It's dangerous. It's really bizarre. And you read this and say, this is amateur hour. And anybody, if it's this organization or the Russian government or, you know, anybody who thought this was going to have a significant effect on the election or American politics, it's kind of out of their minds and silly, and it didn't, and nobody claims it did.
Yeah, let me ask John Kiriakou. You were with the CIA for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Kavanaugh saying, if you read this, and if people really actually read the indictment and just don't go by the breathless headlines, it does look like the amateur hour. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like a sophisticated operation. And again, if you look at the indictment, there's no connection to the Russian government or Russian intelligence. In fact, this indictment tracks the earlier publication that was in Mother Jones and other places by the anti-Putin media outlet. I think it's RBC here. Maybe it's RBK in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
But this indictment actually carefully and clearly and closely tracks these earlier allegations about the so-called meddling. But talk about it as statecraft. Does is it a sophisticated thing?
I would actually use the same term that Jim Kavanaugh just used and call it amateur hour. This is not a professional intelligence operation. It has none of the hallmarks of a professional intelligence operation. This is something that appears to have been confused or ad hoc or something that was just kind of scattershot around the ideological spectrum. What it looks like to me is, as Jim said in the very beginning, as something like a commercial scam. Because look, you can't have a Russian hand, a governmental hand behind something like this that's so well concealed that even the Justice Department can't make a connection, but then have the second half of the operation so poorly executed that your 13 primary people are indicted.
And Jim Jotras, in some ways, this seems to be just for show because the indicted people are not here. They're not going to go on trial. The Mueller knows they're not going to go on trial. This is really about headlines, it would seem to me. It's another kind of economic sanctioning of individuals in Russia, this time with an indictment attached. In other words, it's a form of theater.
I think it is, but I think the theater has a purpose. It's a deflection, it's a distraction from what had been the story over the past few weeks about this conspiracy going on within, as many people have called it, the deep state, the establishment, what you want to call it, is that we have people subverting the rule of law. And this, they'll just take a case in point. Take Fox News, which obviously has a partisan interest to talk about Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and all the rest of them and what they were up to. Suddenly, they're off chasing the new bright, shiny object, saying, look what the Russians were doing. Look what the Russians were doing. That was the purpose of this, to change the focus from what these people have been doing internally in the United States to actually engage in collusion to subvert the rule of law, and instead to say, look at those guys.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, guys. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we were joined from Washington by Jim Jotras. Jim is a political analyst and former U.S. diplomat. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The bipartisan immigration bill failed in the Senate yesterday, as did President Trump's unpopular immigration bill, dooming prospects for reform and casting doubt on the future of dreamers in the country. We're joined from New York by Angie Kim, Community Engagement and Advocacy Coordinator at NACASEC, the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium, and from Seattle by Matt Adams. He's the legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's our pleasure to have you. We had this situation yesterday in the Senate where there were something like four or five different bills. There haven't been any hearings, at least no open hearings. This has all been done behind closed doors in the offices of individual senators, and nothing got even close to 60 votes necessary to pass. In the meantime, and we've said this a number of times on this program in conversations with both of you, the House has never even said that they were going to take up the issue of immigration. So where do we go from here? Angie, let's start with you.
Yes, yesterday was definitely a very emotional and difficult day for myself, as well as my fellow Dreamers and in our immigrant rights community. So you're right. Once again, the Senate failed to pass a common sense solution that will protect, you know, nearly 1.8 million young undocumented immigrants. And you know, what can I say? I mean, we have seen trails of failure in leadership and failure in Congress to move forward and protect our immigrant, youth. And they've obviously, showed that yesterday. It's hard to say where we go from here. There can be, additional amendments that can be introduced in this week. That's really up to the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, as he is sort of in control of the conversation and the process of this debate. So we're hoping to see an amendment or a piece of legislation that will reflect the value of our immigrants and one that will protect the Dreamers without pitting their families against them and endangering the rest of the communities.
Matt Adams, you are an attorney. You work on the legal side of this kind of thing. Donald Trump in the last year has really ratcheted up the detention and expulsion of undocumented workers who have not committed crimes, just people who have been scooped up off the street and then taken to a detention center. What does this mean for people like that and for the Dreamers? Is there any hope for them to have any legal redress or any legal protection? at least in the near term?
I think if we're focusing on the near term, there's very little hope. As you said, not only did the Senate fail to come anywhere close to reaching an agreement, but there was never any serious discussion that the House would entertain a proposal that was put forward by what's being labeled as the centrist group of senators. I mean, if there was any good to be taken away from the events yesterday, it was that Trump's version, the most draconian version of all, received far fewer votes than the other two versions. And the other two versions included draconian terms. They included funding, you know, for this absurd, payment for a border wall, for increasing Border Patrol officers when they don't even have the resources, they don't have enough qualified applicants to fill the positions that currently exist. And so it's not as if the other proposals were something that folks were really excited about, but Trump's proposal was by far the worst and received almost 20 votes less than the others.
Yeah, even in the chatter that you hear from among Republican senators, with the exception of people like Tom Cotton, the arch conservative from Arkansas, for example, there really wasn't broad support for the president's measure. It was those bipartisan bills that garnered, well, I mean, they were far short of the 60 votes, but they got more than 50. I think one was 52 and one was 51 or something like that. But at least we have that the president's version, which is the most draconian, as you point out, is the least popular. With that said, as Angie noted, nobody's protected right now. Go ahead, Angie.
Absolutely. So, out of the four amendments that were introduced yesterday, you're right, and Matt's absolutely right. The Grassley Amendment, which we saw it as a duplication of the White House pillars in their proposal, was by far the worst. I think the most popular one was the Rounds and Kings Amendment that was introduced by Senator Mike Rounds and Angus King. And, you know, by no means was this amendment progressive or friendly for immigrants. It included a lot of the provisions and pieces that would hurt the rest of the communities. And so I think that the atmosphere right now is that there is a momentum, and there's definitely a sense of urgency as we're seeing a lot of these young people who had registered themselves with the government now potentially at the risk of being deported and losing their status, that there is a sense in the Congress to pass something this week. However, the focus should not be just on the urgency to pass any bill. They're taking this opportunity to throw in really terrible reforms that could potentially affect generations of immigrants for our future. So what I am advocating for, along with my community and immigrant rights advocacy group, is that we want a clean bill that does not jeopardize the family members of the Dreamers. You know, I've said this on your show many times over that, you know, this issues around protecting Dreamers is already a majority consensus. Most Americans, over 80% of Americans, believe that we need to protect the Dreamers. However, the Congress has done what they seem to be so very good at, is create this chaos where now they are trying to use this opportunity to implement some of the most terrible immigration reforms, such as a cut to family visa sponsorship. So this matter really should have been just about the Dreamers. And everyone agrees that we need to have a permanent legislative solution for Dreamers without having these other conversations around comprehensive immigration reform, whether that's Republican led or Democrat.
Matt Adams, we've got about 2 minutes left. I want to talk very quickly about a couple of statements that came out of the Senate yesterday. One was from Susan Collins of Maine, a moderate Republican from Maine, who was sort of spearheading this bipartisan effort. She said, "This is the one and only bill that deals with immigration issues with broad bipartisan support." And then there's an interesting note in an article I see Of all places, at Voice of America News, it says hours before the vote, the Department of Homeland Security slammed the Senate proposal's directive on which undocumented immigrants should be targeted for removal as, quote, the end of immigration enforcement in America. But Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina retorted, who the hell wrote this? It sounds like it came from a political hack, not from the Department of Homeland Security. It's as though, as Angie Kim points out, there's a group of Republican senators on Capitol Hill that understands that a clear, strong majority of Americans wants to see legislation enacted to protect dreamers, but others in the Republican Party won't allow it to come to a vote, or will filibuster it so that it doesn't come to a vote. I took an extra minute, so go ahead in the last minute, tell us your thoughts on the possibility that even after these losses, the two sides can come back together and come up with, as Angie says, a clean bill on dreamers.
You know, I don't want to foreclose any hope that might be out there. I just think it's extremely doubtful. When we talk about a clean bill, I just don't see that happening. The Senate and especially Congress is dominated by individuals who feel the need to go along with the Trump agenda and offering red meat to their anti-immigrant supportive base. You know, and I just had one local note. You know, here you just had the chief counsel for the ICE prosecutors plead guilty yesterday to defrauding immigrants who are being deported. The most classic example was he put the names of three different immigrants they had deported as dependents on his tax returns. So you have this type of rampant unaccountability, and yet what we have from the Trump and his administration is saying they want to publish the names of every immigrant who's ever committed a crime to kind of raise that anti-immigrant rhetoric.
Oh, yeah. They'll use it as a hammer. They'll use it as a hammer against immigrants. I'm sorry that we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Angie Kim, Community Engagement and Advocacy Coordinator at the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium, and from Seattle by Matt Adams. He's the legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson arrived in Turkey today in an attempt to repair relations between the two NATO allies. Those relations have frayed over allegations that the U.S. supported a coup against Turkish President Erdogan last year, as well as Turkish demands that the U.S. end support of Kurds in Syria. We're joined from London by Shabir Rezvi. He's an economist and political analyst. Shabir, welcome back.
Hello, yes. Pleasure. Thank you.
Shabir, I've watched Turkey for decades now, three decades, and I don't recall a worse state of relations between the United States and Turkey than what we're seeing right now. What is the state of play between the U.S. and Turkey?
Well, the relationship between Turkey and USA has always been, if you like, a situation between the deep sea and the hard rock. Turkey has also a schizophrenic attitude. They want to be part of Europe, but at the same time, it's a very Asian country, a Muslim country. So there is a sort of a dichotomy in what they are trying to achieve. Because they're part of NATO and the relationship with the USA has been sour, as you quite rightly pointed out, for some time. But it seems to have nosedived in the recent past, in the last few years. You may recall that Turkey was part of the NATO alliance when the Korean crisis broke out, and Turkey had sent its soldiers to fight alongside Australians, USA, and other NATO allies. And Turkey used to have a huge contingent in Korea. So from 50 years, to now, if you like, it's a totally different ballgame that's taking place between Turkey, USA, and its NATO partners. I think there are a number of aspects to it. One is, of course, the coup that happened just over a year ago, and Mr. Erdogan and his party feel that USA was perhaps in some ways, if not instrumental, but certainly created a situation whereby this coup attempt took place. Plus the continuous presence of Mr. Fethullah Gulen, who is in the USA, the Turkish cleric, plus also the detained U.S. consulate workers. There are a whole host of things that are happening. Plus, you must remember that when the whole Syrian crisis happened, Turkish territory was used, and perhaps even to a degree now, for sending ISIS soldiers, ISIS sympathizers from the Turkish mainland, who used to disembark in Istanbul and from there go to the Syrian border and end up in Syria. So Turkey has been playing a dual game, which perhaps I think is coming to bite at this moment. And as I have previously commented, that Turkey is in a similar situation as Pakistan was 30, 40 years ago, when the Taliban were created in Afghanistan with the tacit support of USA and Saudi money. And you see what's happening in Pakistan for the last couple of decades, that they've had nearly 100,000 deaths in Pakistan itself. So it's possible that it's only conjecture at this moment on my part, but it appears that the spillover from Syrian crisis may come home to roost in Turkey itself, like it did in Pakistan. And that would be a real tragedy for the peace and harmony that Turkey wants to create for its population in Turkey.
That is the voice of Shabir Razvi. He is an economist and political analyst who joins us from London. We're talking about Rex Tillerson, the U.S. Secretary of State, visiting Turkey at a time of very difficult relations.
Yeah, John, this is a relationship between the U.S. and Turkey that goes up and down, a little bit like a yo-yo.
Yes.
But there are some anchoring elements to the relationship. Of course, Turkey is the eastern flank of NATO. Turkey is the second largest military in NATO after the United States. The United States has relied on Turkey. U.S./NATO military bases are all over Turkey, and it's an important part, geostrategically important part of the world. We have new contradictions, though. As our guest has pointed out, there was a lot of feeling in Turkey that it was the Russians and not the Americans that saved Erdogan from the military coup d'etat in July 2016. The Russians, perhaps, were the ones who warned him. And at the same time, Turkey and the United States have been at cross purposes about other parts of Syria policy, especially during the end of the Obama administration. Now we have a bigger and more fundamental schism in that relationship, and that has to do with the United States intervention, and it may be, from the point of view of the Pentagon, as we heard from James Mattis, a permanent intervention inside of Syria, maybe 30% of Syrian territory, the northern part of the country, east of the Euphrates, under the control of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, which are really the Kurds, in alliance with the U.S. And the U.S. is actually now even bombing Russian and Syrian positions on behalf of their or alongside their allies, the Kurds. Now, here's, and I want to read to our guest and to the audience a quote from the Russian foreign minister. That's Lavrov. Here's what he says. It is clear that the United States has some strategy which I believe entails staying in Syria forever with its armed forces. They are gearing up for separating a huge part of Syria from the rest of the country, violating Syria's sovereignty of territorial integrity. There they will create quasi-local authorities, will try to create autonomy based on the Kurds. Now, the Kurds, because the Americans can't send hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, they need boots on the ground. Those boots on the ground are the Kurds. But a Kurdish autonomous region, even if it's with the sanction of the United States, is seen by Erdogan and by the Turkish government as an existential threat because there are 13 million Kurds in the eastern part of Turkey who, if they see their brothers and sisters having an autonomous region in Syria, will say, well, we want that too. And that's what Erdogan is against, and that's what pits the United States and Turkey into this sort of a paradoxical relationship.
And before we turn this over to Shabir Rezvi, I want to add something too. I think it actually goes back farther than that. I remember around the year 2000, in the early or the late rather 1990s, Turkey was really on the brink of joining the European Union. It's something that Turkey had aspired to since the 1950s or 1960s, when it was the old European Economic or EEC Commission. And the Turks made significant, serious policy changes. They did away with the death penalty, for example, immediately after the capture of the PKK leader, Abdullah Öcalan. They liberalized their economy and still couldn't get into the EU. And there were issues of, you know, the Cyprus occupation that were supposed to have been dealt with and weren't. But there was this long-term resentment of the Turks against the European Union countries and against the United States, which they believed was urging the EU to not allow Turkey.
Well, let's in our last 2 minutes, Shabir, let's talk about that. What about public opinion in Turkey? It does matter. Where does it stand? I'm looking at pictures of demonstrations against Rex Tillerson in Ankara. Anyway, where is public opinion right now in Turkey, and how big of a deal or how much of a difference does that make?
Well, I think public opinion on this particular point is certainly with Erdogan and the ruling party in Turkey, because at the end of the day, Turkey or the Turkish people want to protect their sovereignty. They certainly do not want the Kurds, the 13 million that you mentioned, to separate away from Turkey. But in a sort of a larger picture, there are Kurds in Iraq, there are Kurds in Iran, Kurds in Syria. So it could be, if you like, a situation which could destabilize all the four countries and that particular region in a more profound way. So I think it's really a huge battle at this moment, whereby Kurds historically have seen themselves to be allied with the USA. And we know very clearly that in the Iraqi part of Kurdistan, they've been Israeli advisors, military personnel at some time been supporting the Kurds. So the Kurds do not have a very good reputation in those four countries. And all those countries will, I don't think, allow the Kurds in any way to have autonomy. But of course, because the situation in Syria is so murky and the chaos that has been created over the last 7 years makes the situation, perhaps that's why the Kurds feel that occupying a part of Syria will allow them in the direction of having an autonomy and carving out a state from these four nations. And I don't think that's on the cards at all.
Something that's we're going to have to watch very closely, because it's certainly not been getting any better the last couple of years. We were joined from London by Shabir Rezvi. Shabir is an economist and political analyst who joined us to discuss Turkey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Federal Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai is being investigated by the FCC Inspector General over allegations that he improperly scrapped regulations to benefit conservative Sinclair Broadcasting in their purchase of rival Tribune Media. We're joined from New York by Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, Tim. Can you explain to our listeners why this is both important and possibly criminal?
Well, it's important because we are seeing media consolidation of a scale we've not seen before, certainly in the space of broadcast television. Sinclair Broadcast Group is attempting to buy Tribune Media that would give it a broadcast reach that could reach about 72% of the nation's population. And it's possibly illegal because we have laws on the books that prevent a single broadcaster from controlling that much of our national media system. The FCC is the agency that oversees the allocation of broadcast licenses, and we have at the FCC a chairman who seems to willing to do anything within his power to help Sinclair complete this merger.
You know, we should add also that Sinclair is one of the largest radio conglomerates in the country. They stretch all across the nation. And Tribune Media is a very large owner of television stations. So this really would give Sinclair a reach across the entire nation. As you said, 72% of households in America.
It would include 233 local television stations. And I mean, that, you know, I think there are legitimate concerns just about letting a single company control that much local media. But Sinclair also has a track record of political bias. It's a very conservative corporation that pushes that conservative agenda over the airwaves. They have must-run commentary segments that espouse very far-right ideology, anti-immigration issues related to gun control, that they create a 2 to 3 minute commentary that they then mandate that all of those, if this merger goes through 233 local TV stations, must carry in their local programming.
Yeah, indeed. Sinclair carries some of the most conservative talk radio programs in America. And no matter where you are in the country, you turn on a Sinclair channel and you're going to get the likes of Rush Limbaugh or Dr. What's-Her-Face. I don't even, I try to block it out of my head. Dr. Whatever.
You succeeded at blocking.
That's right. But yeah, very, very conservative. And, you know, let's talk about Ajit Pai, too. Ajit Pai was the general counsel of, I think it was Verizon.
Yeah, general counsel.
And when he was the general counsel of Verizon, he advocated these kinds of super mergers to consolidate broadcasting power under the control of one or two companies.
Yes, and he is, you know, he's a Trump appointee. What we're calling for, so the news of the week is that an investigation has been launched to see whether there's any quid pro quo, whether Ajit Pai has said that he will extend policy favors to Sinclair Broadcast Group in exchange for pro-Trump programming over its broadcast network. I think there are legitimate concerns about that because there were a number of meetings before he was appointed chair by the Trump administration. There were a number of meetings between Ajit Pai and the executives at Sinclair. So this is a legitimate investigation, and Free Press, my organization, has asked that Ajit Pai recuse himself from all of the proceedings at the FCC as they continue to contemplate whether or not they should approve this merger with Tribune Media.
Your organization, Free Press, has been at the forefront of this kind of thing. And there are several Democrats in Congress that have called both for Ajit Pai to recuse himself and for the Inspector General's office to turn over whatever findings it might have to the Justice Department, because the investigation that we're talking about now at the FCC is an Inspector General's investigation. It's not a criminal probe. But in the event that there is a crime that's been committed here, then the Justice Department would have to take it over.
That's right. And we're looking for the Inspector General's office to hopefully, and they don't have to do this, but to hopefully disclose their findings. The investigation apparently has been going on for a number of months, but the IG's office doesn't comment on any of this. The only way that we found out that this was going on is because one of those members of Congress, Representative Frank Pallone from New Jersey, who's been calling for this investigation, was informed that this investigation was going on. He told a reporter from the New York Times, and earlier this week, the New York Times published that report. So we now know this is happening, which is why we're calling for Pai to recuse himself from any decisions that would impact this merger.
Ajit Pai, let's talk about net neutrality, because that's mm-hmm. where we all learn more about Ajit Pai, and of course, your organization has been in the very front ranks trying to fight for net neutrality, which I consider to be a fundamental fundamental architecture for free speech in America and free choice. I'm looking at one of the media outlets, and we talked, I think, about this in the past. In December, there was the telecom prom that Ajit Pai held for his friends in corporate America.
That's right.
There were protesters who were advocating for net neutrality outside, inside the dinner, also known as the telecom prom, at the Washington Hilton. Pai entertained the audience with jokes about him being a puppet installed by Verizon to lead the FCC. And it's a satirical so-called video. And he said, part of it's Pai coming on the video. He says, in conclusion, sorry, Freudian slip, my bad. Many people are still shell-shocked that I'm up here tonight as chairman. They ask themselves, how on earth did that happen? Well, moments before tonight's dinner, somebody leaked a 14-year-old video that helps answer that question. And in all candor, I can no longer hide from the truth. Verizon executive comes on the video. As you know, the FCC is captured by industry, but we think it's not captured enough. We want to brainwash and groom a Verizon puppet to install as FCC chairman. Think Manchurian candidate. I mean, you know, obviously it's tongue-in-cheek. Obviously it's bad taste. Obviously it's an in-joke for their friends. But it's actually not funny at all.
It's not funny, no.
No, the only people who were laughing were the phone and cable industry lobbyists. At the $500 per plate tables in that telecom prom. Those of us who for years have been advocating for a more diverse and democratic media system through net neutrality, through diverse media ownership, are taking this issue very seriously. And in fact, there was an effort to FOIA all communications between Ajit Pai and Verizon as they prepared for this skit that the FCC refused to reply to. They've said that they cannot provide information about all the communications between Pai and Verizon because it would have a negative impact on their ability to make policy decisions at the agency. So that's all very ironic.
Oh,
that should be a FOIA lawsuit.
That's a lawsuit right there.
I mean, that doesn't hold up.
No, no way. That has FOIA written all over it. FOIA lawsuit.
Well, the FOIA was denied, but I believe that the news organization that was, which is Gizmodo, plans to appeal. So hopefully we'll get to see those emails.
Yeah.
I mean, I look forward to that.
They can't hold them forever. Again, a lawsuit will succeed there. We're joined by Tim Carr. Tim, we're talking to him from New York. He's the senior director of strategy at Free Press. We're talking about the now new investigation that's been revealed, at least by the FCC, about its chairman, Ajit Pai. We're in an epic battle, Tim, about how media and how society deals with media and how it deals with the internet. Talk about what your organization does and how people who care about this, and of course, if they care about their own rights, they have to care about this. Talk about what you do and how people can get involved with you.
Sure. So we advocate for everyone's rights to connect and communicate, which means oftentimes calling for a more democratic and diverse media system, for open access to information, open access to networks that allows people to really control their own media destiny. And Free Press can be found online at freepress.net, where we have a whole lot of information about that and ways that people can get engaged and take action on a number of issues.
One last question. Of course, Donald Trump appointed Ajit Pai, but this isn't strictly a Republican-Democratic issue. Talk about the politics behind it. We have about a minute left.
The politics behind what Pai is doing is really in line with what Trump is doing, which is to try to reverse all of the policies that were put in place by under the Obama administration. And that includes taking away net neutrality rights. That includes allowing for media consolidation of the scale that we've never seen before in history, and really putting control over communications into the hands of fewer and fewer large corporations.
Great. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. I'd like to encourage listeners to go to freepress.net, check out the website and the important work that they do. We were joined from New York by Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy at Free Press. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Patt. He is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Steve, welcome back.
John, I have to jump in and say it's not going to be the worst headlines. It's going to be because there's so many bad, really bad headlines. So we're going to have to focus on a few of the worst headlines.
That's right.
Well, some of them are bad because they're misleading. Some of them are bad because the story is bad. And some of them are just weird and absurd.
And to tell you the truth, you know, we keep this running list over the course of the week. There are so many of them that we just can't get through all of them.
Yeah. And some of them, and of course, I think it's important, again, for the audience to understand many people, not us, because we seriously read all things, but some people only focus on headlines.
That's right.
And so the headline is really perhaps the most important part of the story. We were looking at headlines today on our show earlier, John, about the Florida shooting, where if you read the headline and then you read the content, the article itself, it's completely different.
It's a 180-degree difference.
Steve Patt, where should we start?
Well, let's go with this one. Admiral warns the U.S. must prepare for possibility of war with China.
That's not a funny headline.
Not funny at all. The funny part comes in the subhead, at least funny as far as I'm concerned. I'll read it to you. Harry Harris, the next U.S. ambassador to Australia, says Beijing intends to control the South China Sea.
China out of Asia. China out of Asia. I mean, it's an and he's going to Australia. He's going to be he's Trump's ambassador to Australia, Admiral Harris.
Yeah, he's trying to enlist their help in this coming war.
The important part of that, though, Australia is like, relations between Australia and China are extremely important for Australia. Anyway, go ahead. Let's talk about it.
From the headline, you might actually think that China is preparing for war with the U.S., but of course, it's the opposite.
Well, how dare they put their country so close to our military bases.
Yeah, indeed.
As the old meme goes.
Yeah, I mean, this is a country, the U.S., which has ships in the Black Sea, just to name one place around the world, you know, practically on the border of Russia. And, of course, they have ships in the South China Sea or nearby. So it's just an astonishing headline, an astonishing concept.
But I think in this case, I think the headline was written, it's a Guardian newspaper. I think the headline was written by the paper deliberately to draw attention.
Oh, I agree.
In other words, they're sort of sending out a warning signal here. Hey, pay attention to this. This guy is a top U.S. admiral. He's been now named by Trump to be the ambassador to Australia. Australia is an important part of the Pacific and an important part as a U.S. military ally in the Pacific. They fought with the U.S. in Vietnam and in Korea.
And the Australians historically have seen China as really their only enemy in the world.
Yeah, and it was from Australia in 2011 that Obama announced the Asia pivot, which meant putting U.S. naval and Air Force assets to the tune of about 60% of each of them, all aggregated into the Asia-Pacific region. But I think that The Guardian is trying to send us a message here, and when you read the article, because once you look at that headline, the U.S. must prepare for a war with China, which anybody would think like, oh my God, are you crazy? Because of course that would be crazy. We're talking about probably the end of the human race.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
That's right.
What we're talking about. So we should be really get ready for that one. But let's listen to some of the ambassador, Admiral Harris's words. At the end of the day, the ability to wage war is important, or you become a paper tiger, borrowing a phrase from Chairman Mao. I'm hopeful that it won't come to a conflict with China, but we must all be prepared for that if it should come to that. And then he says, China's impressive military buildup will soon challenge the United States, and we ignore them at our peril. I mean, this is madness. I think The Guardian, in fact, with this headline, Steve Patt, was doing us in the world a favor by saying, look, you guys have a crazy admiral who wants to prepare the public for war with China, but he's not just this weird rogue Dr. Strange Lovian character. He just got named to be the ambassador from the United States to Australia.
Well, I'd be comforted if I thought the admiral was the only one whose thinking was along these lines, but I'm afraid I'm not. One of the other story, China story that's in the news this week, is that the FBI, CIA, and NSA, this is part of their testimony before Congress earlier this week, warned American citizens that we should not use Chinese phones, these Huawei, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, phones, because they might be spying on us and sending information back to China. This from the FBI, CIA, and NSA. I hardly need to say any more.
Well, no, but let's say a little bit more, just in case people might not get the tongue-in-cheek there, John. The FBI doesn't want us using Chinese phones because mm-hmm. China could spy on Americans, and that should be the exclusive domain of the FBI, the NSA, and other U.S. intelligence
right.
agencies. Where it's their surveillance state, not China's surveillance
to
state.
To tell you the truth, I feel much more comfortable with the Chinese intercepting my calls than with the Americans. The Chinese have never done
me
any wrong.
Well, it didn't work out for you last time. When
no,
they,
it you, didn't,
two
indeed.
And a half years in prison.
That's right.
Now, needless to say, there's no evidence of any of this that China is using the Huawei phones to spy on Americans, and it would be a trivial matter for the CIA, FBI, or NSA to buy some phones and verify they're not sending information back to China. But here's the interesting irony: this is from an article from Mashable, which is a tech publication. In 2012, it was revealed that the NSA had made a program called Shot Giant that created back doors into Huawei-made equipment in order to monitor communications around the world and find ties between the Chinese company and the Chinese People's Liberation Army, which they didn't find any. So it's the NSA has been the one who's been planting spyware into Huawei phones, not the Chinese government. So it's really like triple irony or something. I don't know.
Yeah, there's other ways to express that, double whammy, but that's I'm glad you pointed it out. You know, Steve, we agreed in the beginning when we started this series that we were not going to use headlines from The Onion because because they're just weird and bizarre and funny and ironic and sarcastic on purpose. We're talking about headlines that weren't intended to be that way. So I see that you've picked a headline here, and you say, just so that John and I weren't confused, this is not The Onion.
Not The Onion.
Not The Onion. Let's listen to this headline.
Yeah, I hate to pick on Elon Musk again. We did that last week, and I actually have friends who work at Tesla, very nice people. But this headline, which actually was from last year but resurfaced in social media this week, reads as follows. Elon Musk decries UAW union, promises employees frozen yogurt and roller coaster machine.
That should do it. Why should you have workers' rights? Why should you have a grievance procedure? Why should you have guarantees? But now, Steve Pat, this is The Onion. Tell us the truth.
No, it's from the San Francisco Chronicle, believe it or not.
And you know, Steve, some of the, in this San Francisco Chronicle article, some of the quotes from Musk, if he actually said these things, shame on him. He says that there would be, quote, free frozen yogurt stands scattered around the factory, as well as a Tesla electric pod car roller coaster. In his words, quote, it's going to get crazy good, unquote.
Where's this guy from, Mars?
Actually, he's from Russia. But
he wants to go to Mars.
He's from South Africa.
Oh, he's from South Africa. You're absolutely right. I'm sorry. Yeah, he is notoriously anti-union. That's the serious part of the fiddle.
We have 2 minutes left.
Let's just go with another funny one.
Go ahead.
Right above there, which we can hardly resist saying this. The headline reads as follows. Russian nuclear weapons engineers caught minting blockcoin or blockchain with supercomputer. So that's what the Russians are really doing with their military might. They got their engineers making Bitcoin on the, you know, on the side.
They'll stop at nothing. We have 90 seconds left. I like this other headline. Pence's Olympic mission, countering North Korean propaganda. That's why he went to the Olympics? I mean, that must have been news for the American athletes. But when you looked at him in the box there, he's sitting there, arms folded, all grim. Everybody else in the world, in the stadium meeting, are on their feet cheering as the two Koreas march together under one Korean flag. He's sitting a few inches away from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Jong-nam, another leading official from North Korea. Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, comes to the box. He shakes hands with the North Korean official. Then you have this grim steely-eyed Mike Pence looking grim and
raw. He took a knee at a sporting event to protest something that had nothing to do with the game.
He took a knee for war.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think we have to read one sentence. This is from the Washington Post, and this is how they describe Mike Pence. Pence had transformed himself into something of an anti-propaganda warrior, a mild-mannered, if resolute, superhero who arrived in South Korea on the eve of the Winter Games to single-handedly rebuff North Korea's public relations efforts.
Awesome.
I mean, talk about propaganda.
He did it. I have to say, he did an amazing job. He single-handedly turned the entire world against Mike Pence. I mean, the whole world was sitting there looking at this Grinch. Everybody else is up cheering, thinking peace could break out in the Korean Peninsula. It is the Olympics, which is known for bringing people together, but no.
No. No. Unfortunately, we're out of time, guys. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.